Support for Science Friday's podcast comes from Squarespace, the award-winning website builder that helps you share your story with the world. Start a free trial at squarespace.com/Friday. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, do you fly too much? You leave the window open when the heat's on? Is your carbon footprint a size too big? We'll be taking your climate confessions with Sci-Fi alum Flora Lichtman of the Adapters podcast. But first, the debate over net neutrality has been raging ever since the Federal Communications Commission called for citizen comments on the issue this summer. President Obama made his position known during last month's State of the Union address.
I intend to protect a free and open Internet, extend its reach to every classroom and every community, and help folks build the fastest networks so that the next generation of digital innovators and entrepreneurs have the platform to keep reshaping our world.
This week, FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler caught a lot of observers by surprise when he responded with a proposal that he described as, quote, the strongest open Internet protections ever proposed by the FCC. The rules would regulate Internet service under Title II, treating it as a public utility. What does all of that mean? My next guest is here to walk us through the proposal. Kevin Werbach is an associate professor of legal studies and business ethics at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. He's a former FCC legal counsel during the Clinton administration. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me, Ira.
Take us what that means. What does Title II mean, and what does that do for this?
Title II is a section of the Communications Act, which is the statute that regulates telecommunications and other services, and it's the section of the law that traditionally applied to things like telephone service. About 10 or so years ago, the FCC decided that broadband access was not a Title II service. It was what was called an information service. And they've been struggling ever since to figure out how to address issues for broadband, in particular, how to address concerns about discrimination by broadband providers. So now, for the first time, the FCC is assuming they vote for this proposal, adopt an order classifying broadband under those provisions.
And that makes it more neutral?
Well, it gives the FCC legal authority to implement rules, which is what the rest of the order is going to do, that describe what kinds of practices broadband providers can't engage in. So they can't block traffic. They can't say, we don't like this content, we don't like this programming, we're just not going to carry it. They can't throttle it. They can't say, well, if you pay us, then certain traffic will go through, but if you don't pay us, then your traffic's going to get deliberately slowed down. And they can't discriminate. They can't unreasonably treat some services differently than other services.
So does this give net neutralists at least a bit of hope that they'll get what they want?
This is what they want. So yeah. These are basically the kinds of rules that advocates for net neutrality have been pushing for. I should say the original proposal that came from Chairman Wheeler at the FCC last spring also was a set of net neutrality rules. The advocates for net neutrality wanted the FCC to do this reclassification under Title II, partly because they thought it was a stronger legal foundation. The order is going to get challenged in court, and partly because they felt that the FCC could go further in some of the kinds of discrimination that it prohibited. Mm-hmm. But all along, the FCC has been proposing net neutrality rules. The FCC actually passed net neutrality rules in 2010, but they were overturned last year by a federal court.
There was an interesting article in the Wall Street Journal today that showed that President Obama actually really used his influence to bring a tougher set of net neutrality rules to Tom Wheeler.
Well, the FCC is an independent agency. So the president nominated Tom Wheeler, and they've known, Tom Wheeler has worked with the president for a long time. But once he became confirmed as the chairman of the FCC, he's not required to follow the directives of the president. He can make his own decisions. That being said, once President Obama made that statement, the public statement that he felt that the FCC had to reclassify, it became almost impossible just as a practical matter because the FCC chairman has to get 3 votes on the commission for any proposal to go through. It became just about impossible for him not to do some kind of Title II rule.
Mm-hmm. So do you think he'll get those 3 votes, and do you think that Congress is going to go along with this?
Yeah, so the way the commission works is when there's a Democrat in the White House, they get a majority on the commission. So there are three Democrats on the five-member FCC. They, in all likelihood, the three of them will vote for this proposal, and the two Republicans will vote against it. So it will get adopted. There's still a process of public comment and negotiation for the next 3 weeks before they get to that point. Basically, what has just happened is the chairman has circulated the formal draft to the other commissioners, and then there's a process before they actually vote on it. As you said, Congress has made it clear they're going to weigh in. The Republicans in Congress have introduced some legislation that would impose a variety of net neutrality requirements that would bar certain kinds of discrimination, but it would forbid the FCC from taking any further action. It would remove the FCC's what's called rulemaking authority and would prevent broadband internet from going under these Title II provisions. So we'll see if that passes. It certainly, I would think, doesn't have a great likelihood of getting passed and getting through President Obama, who in all likelihood would veto it. But there's no doubt there's going to be a lot of noise and discussion on this in Congress over the next year.
And we also have legal challenges, right, from some of the providers?
Oh, yeah. The companies like Comcast and Verizon and AT&T, the broadband access providers, most of them have already said they're going to sue. They have to wait until the order gets adopted. It gets in the Federal Register, so that might be a couple of months. Then they file the lawsuit. Then there's a several-month period until it gets heard. So we're talking at least next year before those legal cases get resolved, and possibly even substantially longer.
So it could be that this could go through this president's term in office and be on the next president's lap.
Oh, yeah. We've been fighting about this for over a decade, really. The idea of net neutrality was first described around 2002, 2003, and the FCC has been taking formal action on net neutrality since about 2007. So the fact that this is not the end shouldn't really be a surprise to anyone.
There's a little side issue that did not get as much notice because this is such a embattled area. The regulations might help cities set up municipal broadbands, right? That they could run for free.
Well, that's part of a larger effort that's going on. That the issue of municipal broadband is not specifically a network neutrality issue. There's two areas. One is there are a variety of states that have laws prohibiting municipal broadband networks, prohibiting cities from building their own broadband networks. And what the president and Chairman Wheeler have said is that's crazy. We need more competition for broadband, not less. We shouldn't be stopping competition from happening. That's a separate proceeding from the net neutrality mm-hmm. proceeding, but it's in a similar vein. Mm-hmm. The second issue is that the Title II has provisions for the price that you pay and the access that you get to poles and conduits. If you want to run wires along telephone poles and under the streets, if you are a Title II provider, a telecommunications provider under the statute, you get a better deal than if you're not. So to the extent that these other broadband competitors, things like Google Fiber and other broadband networks that want to go and compete, to the extent that they are now classified under Title II, that does give them not free access, but it gives them better and easier access to build their networks.
Are we seeing sort of a change in the guard? Now we have these young, rich entrepreneurs in their 20s and 30s who are taking on the FCC and whatever because they're nimbler and they believe in having a more open society, open internet here.
I think the FCC believes in an open society and an open internet as well. And when I was at the FCC, got there almost or over 20 years ago, we were spending a lot of time and energy working with companies in Silicon Valley and the nascent internet companies back then, and they were talking with us. I think there's kind of a reflexive view among some parts of the technology world that government is always the problem. And I think open internet, net neutrality, has confronted a lot of companies with the realization that government is also part of the solution, that sometimes you need government to ensure that markets are open so that competition can happen. One of the striking things this time around compared to 2010 when the FCC previously adopted the rules is it wasn't just big companies like Google that were weighing in for net neutrality. You had a lot of smaller companies like Meetup and Kickstarter and Etsy, that were coming in and saying to the FCC, look, we're a startup. We are just getting off the ground, and this openness is really important to us. And, yeah, I think that has an impact when you hear that from people who are really putting all of their sweat and toil and everything else into building these companies.
And that's what they were saying, basically. Look, if you want to help startups, if you want to promote startups, you know, we need that ability to think creatively and to do new things.
Oh, absolutely. And again, it's so easy to say that government is big and dumb and always favors incumbents. It certainly wasn't my experience in the time that I've been in government. Certainly government can do dumb things, but frankly, companies can do dumb things too. And I think in this area in particular, and especially in this administration, I mean, President Obama has come in from the beginning saying that he believed in the extraordinary power of technology to improve people's lives and also to help develop the economy. And so I think that the team that he has, both the team in the White House and the team at the FCC and elsewhere, those are their values. So it shouldn't be terribly shocking to anyone that that's what led them to this set of decisions.
You think he'll get any bipartisan support on this?
You know, what's interesting is that net neutrality has not always been a purely partisan issue. So actually, the first net neutrality action was done by Kevin Martin, who was the Republican chairman of the FCC during part of the Bush administration. He was the one who adopted sanctions for the first time against Comcast when they were slowing down BitTorrent. So it's not just something that Democrats favor. And frankly, if you look at the comments on net neutrality, there are comments that come in from conservative groups, religious groups, that say, look, we're concerned as well about large entities. They're the ones who talk about the liberal media and how much power it has. They're worried, too, about big companies acting as gatekeepers and stopping unpopular views from going through. So if you look at the polling about who cares about net neutrality, I mean, forget about the intricacies of the rules and laws in D.C. Do people think that broadband providers should not be allowed to engage in discrimination against content? Overwhelming numbers among both Democrats and Republicans.
All right. We're good. Thank you, Kevin. Quite interesting. We'll be watching it. Who knows how long it will take. We might have to call for your expertise one more time. Thanks for joining us. Kevin Warbeck is Associate Professor of Legal Studies and Business Ethics at that famous Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, Flora Lichtman is here to talk about your climate confessions. Get them out now. We're not judging you. We're just going to have you confess a little. No one's listening anyhow. So we'll be right back after the break. This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. You ever had that moment when you're standing in front of a trash can, you got an empty plastic bottle in your hand, and you know you should recycle it, right? But hey, there's no recycling bin to be found. So you hesitate a second, you look around, and then you quickly toss it into the trash, hoping no one's secretly judging you. Sound familiar? I must confess, I have done that. I've said it. I feel better. Well, today we want to hear your climate guilt. What could you be doing better in terms of reducing your carbon footprint? But, well, you just haven't gotten around to it yet, right? So in the spirit of transparency, we took a quick poll at the Science Friday offices. And let's just say there aren't any eco-angels around there.
Probably my biggest sin is that I take showers that are never less than 10 minutes long.
I don't recycle, ever.
Sometimes I leave my lights on when I leave my apartment.
I blow dry my hair every day.
Drying clothes at high heat.
Oh, nasty, nasty. What about you? We want to hear your confessions today. Give us a call at 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK. We have counselors here standing by to help you out, talk you off the ledge if necessary. And as I say, there's no judging, Flora. Flora Lichtman is, of course, a Sci-Fi alum. She's host of a new podcast, The Adapters, a new project from Sound Vision Productions. Good to see you, Flora.
Oh, thank you for having me, Ira. It's good to be here.
Tell us about this. How did this climate confessions idea come about?
Well, you know me. I have a lot of guilt in general. This is one piece of my guilty pie. I mean, I have a million confessions. I'm that person. I take long showers. I could go on and on. But yeah, Basically, I felt like I'm probably not the only one who feels like this. And it sounded fun in a weird way to kind of collect these moments from people. And the idea is it's definitely a judgment-free zone. I mean, I feel like the idea is not to make anybody feel worse, but kind of the opposite, to commune and to give people some information about what choices in their lives actually do matter.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's amazing how many confessions you probably come up with If you just think about it for a while,
right? Oh, my gosh. And they've already come pouring in. I mean, we launched this project at the New York Hall of Science in Queens, and we set up a booth, basically,
yeah,
a confessional, right, and we had hundreds of people come by. I was there for 4 days, so I heard,
wow,
like 20 hours of confessions, and it was amazing. I mean, here are some take-home points. Like, one, shower shame, really prevalent. A lot of people feeling the shower shame over hot showers, long showers, recycling regrets big time. And we had lots of kids come through too. In fact, I think we have a clip of one of the kids who came in and gave us a call on our confessional hotline.
Hi, I'm Nicholas. Once I went down to the beach and I was eating crackers and I didn't have a place to throw out the wrappers. I couldn't find it, so I threw the wrapper onto the ground and buried it. Bye.
Oh, he feels...
Bye.
He feels so guilty.
I told him it was okay. I mean, yeah, but it was funny. We had a lot of kids. Littering has been really well messaged because kids have these like post-traumatic memories of littering episodes in their life.
Mm. Let's see if we have confessors on the line here. I think we have a few confessors on the line. Let's go right to the top of the order here. Let's go to Nora in Houston. Hi, Nora. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
I have a confession and maybe observation. The confession is I recycle paper, but I never get to do the plastic. And I try, and I try to organize, but I just never get to it. And I feel very guilty because I am, like, as far as it comes to paper, I will not let one piece of paper not to be recycled. But I don't know why I have such a hard time with the plastic.
It's so fascinating. I have all this residual guilt about not recycling paper. So I've become a great paper recycler, but I wasn't for many years, and I had the reverse problem.
So have you?
Okay.
Well, don't feel too guilty about it, Nora. We don't want you, you know.
I know.
Sleep at
I
night.
Feel guilty because I have a lot of kids, so I need to make them aware of it as well, as I have to start with myself.
Yeah,
of course. Yeah. But the other observation is I go to pick up our children every day at the school in the carpool, and the line to the school starts 30, 40 minutes before the kids are out of school. But I've noticed a lot of parents do not turn the cars off, and it's idling or the engine running for 30, 40 minutes. So I do not know how to start a movement to stop it. I feel like going and knocking on people's car doors and windows and saying, please turn your car off. You don't need to have it running. But a lot of parents are guilty of this.
That's true. That's true. Floria, you know, it sounds like a Seinfeld episode. But
it really does. I would love to hear how it goes, how the movement goes, if you try actually. I mean, we heard this from a lot of people who stopped by the confessional, is that they notice things in their lives and they didn't know how to approach people because it's kind of awkward. You don't want to call anybody out. And you don't want to, you know,
The goal is not to make them feel guilty, right?
No, just but to inform.
To inform. We've got a lot of people on the phone with confessions. I don't know. Let's go to Susan in Bristol, Virginia. Hi, Susan.
Hello.
Hey there. Are you? Do you have something to confess?
My confession is that my husband and I became pilots and bought a Cessna 182. And a Cessna 182 is a wonderful way to get back and forth to the beach and so forth, but the airplane just burns fuel like crazy. And I became a pilot for South Wings, which is a volunteer pilot network, and I did a lot of flight work, especially over the mountaintop removal mining in West Virginia and Kentucky. And I felt like that mitigated my heavy footprint with burning gasoline.
So you knew you had a big footprint that you were trying to offload onto some charity work.
That's right.
Have you heard from any pilots?
Well, you know, this was one of the epiphanies for me. We had all these climate counselors at the NYSCI event, and you know, I realized that my air travel blows my carbon footprint out of the water. So, you know, I live in New York. I don't have a car. I was feeling pretty good about myself. Low impact me. And then, you know, all my plane travel for work, and also I like to travel. I've just begun to internalize the guilt about that.
But you I know you. I've known you for you're a big bicyclist. You bicycle from Brooklyn to Manhattan.
I know, but it doesn't even begin to offset those cross-country plane trips.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have climate guilt?
I have. I did that. When I said I have done the thing where I'm taking a load of plastic bottles down, and I have too many bottles, and I throw one into the other bin, and I say, oh, I feel bad, but I just have no. I'll have to pay for it some other way. I've done that, but there are times when you live in Manhattan in a big city, you can walk, but as soon as you get to the suburbs, five blocks is too long to walk. Where I'd be walking for blocks and blocks here today, and I feel guilty about doing that. So
yeah.
All right. Well, let's bring on another expert, and this is somebody you might be familiar with. Mike Berners-Lee is author of How Bad Are Bananas? The Carbon Footprint of Everything, and The Burning Question. He's also director of Small World Consulting. That's a sustainability consultancy in the UK, and he joins us from Kendal, England. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
I know you're an expert on sustainability, but no one's exempt today. We're going to have to ask you, Mike, do you have a confession to make?
Well, I've got lots of guilty confessions to make, and I'm just like every other person in the world, really. So, I've heard some of the programs so far, and it's absolutely right that it's no good beating ourselves up. It's not about giving each other a hard time, because we've all got plenty of things we can feel guilty about. And you ask anyone in my family, there's plenty of things in my lifestyle that aren't perfect. But it is about just trying to find a few things that you can do, picking your battles, finding a few significant things and then doing them right, and trying to find some things that you can do that cut the carbon whilst making your life better, not worse as well.
Now, what's interesting is in your books, you talk about a carbon footprint and that there's a lot of mythology about the carbon footprint. Give us some idea of that.
Well, the thing about carbon is it's this invisible gas, and most of us don't have any sense or any instinct of what's a big carbon footprint and what's a small carbon footprint. And a lot of the talk that goes on about sort of carbon counting is quite often mumbo jumbo, and it leaves a lot of us confused. And what we all need to try and get, and what the book was trying to do, is just trying to get across just an instinct for what kind of things have a really small carbon footprint, and what kind of things, especially in terms of our lifestyles, have a big carbon footprint. So, for example, I was asked a while ago by somebody, Mike, well, how should I dry my hands when I go to the toilet? Should I use an electric hand dryer, or should I be using a paper towel, or should I just kind of shake my hands a bit, or what? And this person was agonizing over it. And the same person flies across the Atlantic several times a month. And it's just like, you've got to understand that's the wrong question. You're talking about, there's a factor of a million difference between the carbon footprint of getting on an airplane and the carbon footprint of drying your hands. And you should focus on the things that matter and less on the things that don't matter.
How do you know what matters? I mean, you think you think you may know something. Carbon footprint, and it really turns out if you take in all the factors, it's a high carbon footprint.
Yeah, sure, and it's not easy. That's why I wrote the book. So buy the book. But but it's about thinking about what lies behind what I'm buying. So for example, somebody gives you a rose for Valentine's Day. It's coming up, or you give someone else a rose for Valentine's Day, and it just looks like a lovely rose. But we've got to get into the habit of thinking, okay, but this product has got a history on it. And was it grown locally in somebody's garden? Okay, where I live, that's unlikely in February. Or has it been air freighted across the world? Or has it been hot housed? Or what? So that you get some kind of, just by kind of getting into the habit of thinking, what lies behind what I'm doing here? So, I mean, some carbon footprints are more obvious than others.
Yeah.
So if you get in a car, there's exhaust coming out of the exhaust pipe.
Yeah.
And if you get in an airplane, you kind of know that there's a lot of exhaust coming out of that as well. But products are less obvious.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Let's go to Jennifer in Alexandria, because I know she's thinking about this. Jennifer?
Hi there. Happy Friday.
Thank you.
I am calling to confess that we as a family throw out a lot of uneaten food.
Mm. Yeah, how much food do you throw out?
Well, I have three kids, and they're growing, and a husband, and we just never seem to manage to eat everything, whether I cook it or it's takeout. And we even throw out stuff that's gifts things in the freezer that, you know, we have sat there for too long. And I have a lot of guilt about that for a variety of reasons.
So you do think about it. Flora, she does think about how she might be better.
I totally relate, Jennifer. I have this hummus container in my... It's a dual guilt because both I didn't eat it and I really don't want to rinse it out. And it's just been sitting there for weeks in my fridge.
I have five of those in my fridge.
You have three kids. You have, I have five of them. Well, okay, Jennifer. We hope you feel better now that you've confessed to us.
I do. But, you know, I want to become better at managing, purchasing food and, you know, portioning it for a family. And it's really hard to do.
Yeah.
And portions are so large at restaurants.
Right.
Yes. So, yeah. But I feel better for confessing.
Okay, we feel your pain, Jennifer. thank you for taking
Thanks
time to
for
do
taking
this.
My call.
You're welcome. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking now with Flora Lichtman, who has got a new blog, The Adapters. Tell us about the blog a little.
So it's a brand new super science-y podcast, and it's about climate change, but in a fun way. That's what we're saying anyway. Yeah. We're doing stories about inventors and offbeat alternative energies. We came out of the gate. So we launched a couple weeks ago, and one of our first stories was about how microbes are turning sewage into natural gas. So two of my favorite topics.
Oh, I know that.
Microbes.
I remember.
I'm keeping those beets alive in this new project. And that kind of thing. We're really trying to explore both kind of big solutions that seem to be
right.
working, and also the really out there ideas that you don't hear much about.
Where can I hear your podcast?
You can go to theadapters.org and subscribe, or you can find it on iTunes too.
And how often do you make a new one?
We're out every couple of weeks, and we're doing videos, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So you can find those on YouTube and Vimeo as well.
All right, let's go to the phones. So let's go to Nikki in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Hi, Nikki.
Hey there. Hey, well, I have a confession. When I first started becoming a recycler, but that was of a comment for Jennifer, the person who throws out her a lot of food. Once we started having backyard chickens, that problem just went completely away. So any food at all that we have left over, we take it outside and we let those chickens eat it, whether we bring it home from, you know, restaurants or we're eating it for dinner. And our food seems to never go to waste because
wow.
we get to just take it out there to the chickens.
Have you thought of goats?
Oh, yeah. We had a goat, too. And she met a sad demise. But, yeah, that thing, she ate everything. And we had a potbelly pig, too, at one time who eats a lot of leftovers as well.
Wow.
Oh. But anyway, to my confession, and this was about a decade ago, is when I started becoming a recycler. We had some friends over. And we're just chatting in the kitchen. I had a gallon of milk. I had just finished the gallon of milk. I was pouring a glass for my toddler. And as I finished the gallon, I took the gallon of milk, the container, and I squeezed all the air out in between my legs, and I put the cap on. My friend Jimmy, he goes, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm squeezing all the air out of the container because then this will take up less room in the landfill." And he goes, what are you talking about? You just need to start recycling. And it was that moment when I was like, oh, you're right, I just need to start recycling.
That's...
So we've been a recycling family ever since.
Well, I mean, Mike, you've got a comment on that.
Yeah, sure. So I think the food the food issue is a big deal. And the person who was saying about they're guilty uneaten food. I mean, the good news is that there's a world of opportunity there. So there's things like soup, and so there's a local supermarket near me that does a great job of giving out soup recipes after Christmas and persuading everybody that all their customers' fridges are full of Christmas waste, Christmas food that's just going to go off. So they just encourage everybody to make loads of soup, and actually it's delicious and it's a kind of a forgotten thing, and if you're thinking about what to do with your food waste, then anything's better than putting it in landfill. But really what you should absolutely be trying to do with it is making sure that it goes into a human mouth if you possibly can. So soups and also just leftovers are kind of a forgotten delicacy.
Yeah, I make a soup out of it or stew out of it. It's quite interesting. All right, can you hang around a little longer?
Please.
We're gonna take a break. When we come back, we'll get a few more confessions in. Our number is 844-724-8255. You can tweet us at Cy Fry. Some tweets are coming in. It says, flying for business and pleasure. I'd rather take the train for the adventure and the climate, but I can't spare the time and the money. It's expensive, J.C. Kibbe writes. We'll take some more of your tweets and your phone calls after the break. Stay with us. Hey, podcast listeners. Take a look around. Chances are, if there's something stunning, you'll stop and stare at it for a while. That's the power of Squarespace, a sponsor of today's podcast. Its platform is easy yet powerful, so you get superior engineering and high functionality when you want it. Everything is mobile responsive, so your website looks elegant in any size window. And because you're a Sci-Fry listener, you can try it for free at squarespace.com/Friday. In case you just joined us, you're listening to Science Friday. We're talking this hour about, well, your carbon footprint, your carbon confessions. Can you confess about what you do that you're feeling guilty about? With Flora Lichtman, she is a host of the Adapters podcast, a new project from Sound Visions Productions. Mike Berners-Lee, author of How Bad Are Bananas? The Carbon Footprint of Everything. And the burning question. Our number 844-724-8255. We're also taking confessions in as a tweet. And here's, well, the most interesting tweet, a confession from Bobby Ellis, who says he confesses to excessive flatulence. I'm sure my personal methane production contributes to global warming. Well, you have Flora here, anything like that on your confession?
That's the best one I've heard yet. Thank you for that tweet. It's made my day. I'm curious, Mike. Is that something we should be worried about?
Well, methane in large quantities, yes, we should be concerned about it. So methane from cows, yes. Methane from people, it's tiny. So a kilo of methane would have about the same carbon footprint as, I don't know, a 50-mile drive or something. But if you think about what it would take to have a kilo's worth of flatulence, that would be quite a lot of gas. So I think your Twitter can relax.
Can you do anything for the cows to make them less flatulent, the cows?
Well, there are scientists out there claiming that they can get marginal improvements, but basically no, and it's a problem. So, But the good news is there are alternative meats that aren't from ruminants and don't flatulate, like chicken, and there's also even alternatives to meat. So there are ways around the problem.
Yeah, let's go to the phones. Let's see if we can take a phone call or two from Dylan in Columbia, Maryland. Hi, Dylan.
Hi, yes. I actually do not have a confession, although I do commit many recycling sins. I do have more of a comment about sort of carbon footprint shaming that goes on in Japan. So when you have a residence in Japan, you get a certain number of stickers that you could put on your trash bags. And if you run out of these stickers and you're a wasteful person, you have to purchase more. And not only are these stickers replacements, but they're a bright, bright purple. So that anybody that sees your bags, they know that you're a wasteful person.
Wow, so that's like shaming people.
Yeah, and exactly.
That's direct guilt. Mike, what do you think of that technique?
Well, I think it's good that we all get to face up to the implications of what we do and that things become transparent. My only thought is that it's a shame they couldn't find some scheme that lets people look good when they're not putting a lot of stuff in the trash, rather than emphasizing a scheme that makes people look bad when they do put a lot of stuff in. So, you know, I'm more in favor of positive schemes, I think.
Well, let's talk about a positive scheme. Is there one overwhelming thing that you've found out that people can do? If they had to try one thing.
Well, okay, so, yeah, well, it depends on what your lifestyle is. So, you know, for me, so it's a very personal thing. So for me, when I started riding a bike and getting the train to work rather than going in a car, that was a really good life improvement that saved a lot of carbon. When I started being a lot more selective about when I fly, so I still fly if there's a very good reason for it, but I won't fly without a really, really good reason. You know, that's a good way of saving a lot of carbon, and it's also a good way of improving your life, actually, because the experience of actually being sat there on a plane is hardly a great thing to happen in your life. a lot of us could save a big chunk of carbon by wasting less food, which has already come up, and you save money just by the way as well, or changing diet a bit, or energy saving. So it's different for all of us.
All right, Flora, you have anything?
Well, one comment
that you would make to our listeners about
what they might do. I would say even just being aware seems like a good first step. And I'm really glad to have heard from the Science Friday listeners, and thanks for having me.
Well, we hope you get lots more Science Friday listeners to your podcast.
Oh, thank you
so much. When can they hear them again?
They can go to iTunes or theadapters.org. And if you have a confession that you didn't get to make, we have a confessional hotline.
Any time of the day, you can get it off your chest.
Yes, it's open all the time. 844-U, the letter U, fess up is the number.
Flora Lichtman is, of course, a Sci-Fry alum and host of The Adapters, a new podcast, a project from Sound Vision Productions. We love those folks out in San Francisco, too. Thank you, Flora, for taking time to be with us. Always good to see you.
Great to see you.
Mike Berners-Lee is author of How Bad Are Bananas? The Carbon Footprint of Everything. And he's also author of The Burning Question and director of Small World Consulting in the UK. And yes, he is the brother of Tim Berners-Lee. Thank you, Mike, for taking time to be with us today.
Pleasure. Thanks.
The waters off Northern California are becoming warmer due to global warming, and scientists are still trying to untangle the consequences. But one thing they have noticed is all sorts of animals that are not usually seen in the area. One of these animals is a sea slug called the Hopkins Rose. If you're imagining a slimy brown slug you find in your garden, think again. My next guest is here to open your mind to the diversity. There really is tremendous diversity of these little creatures. And he's going to give us an update on the latest in sea slug science. Terry Goslinger is a senior curator of invertebrate and zoology, geology at the California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco. And he joins us from KQED there. Welcome to Science Friday.
Well, thank you very much.
Is there a definition for what a sea slug is?
Well, a sea slug is basically a marine snail without a shell, and they are tremendously varied and live in every part of the ocean.
Is it related to the garden slug?
They are distant cousins of the garden slugs, yes.
Mm-hmm. So what would they, a nudibranch?
Well, that would be a more formal name for a sea slug, and it nudibranch means that it has a naked gill. The gill is not surrounded by the shell.
Hmm. Now, the Hopkins Rose is usually found in Southern California, but as I'm saying, you're seeing it increase where you are in San Francisco. Is that a problem?
Well, the presence of the nudibranchs is not a problem in itself, but what the cause behind it is where the problem is, and that is that unusually warm waters are being found off our coast. And while we're really enjoying seeing so many of these unusual slugs that are usually a rare treat in the Bay Area, it's reflective of much warmer ocean conditions, and other organisms are suffering as a result of those warm waters.
Mm-hmm. How are they suffering, the other?
Well, one of the things we're finding, for example, is that a lot of seabirds like the Cassin's auklet have been dying in large numbers because there's just not enough food, because the warmer water also means that it's less nutrient rich. And other things like there's been a lot of California sea lion pups coming ashore emaciated in the last several weeks. And because, again, there are not enough fish to feed on because the water's warmer.
Huh. That's quite interesting. Now, let's talk about the sea slug for a moment, the Hopkins Rose and the other sea slugs. They are not, as I say, the typical garden variety, the ugly ones that you see. These are quite beautiful, aren't they?
They're strikingly beautiful, and they are abundant in psychedelic colors. The Hopkins Rose in itself is a bright, hot pink with lots of finger-like projections sticking out of its back. It's about a half an inch to an inch in length, and it's you can't miss it when you see it in a tide pool. You can see it from 10 yards away because it just looks like this bright pink rose in an otherwise dark backgrounded tide pool.
And I've seen pictures of sea slugs that they look like they have little tentacles and things like
they do.
Spikes
they
coming off of them.
They have sensory organs on the head. They have they have a gill on the back for the most part, and they have lots of projections that can detect changes in their environment and detect their food and the presence of members of their own species with which they can mate.
There was a study that came out this week that showed a sea slug can actually steal genes from algae. What does it do with that? How does it do that? What does it do with the genes?
Well, there's one group of slugs that feeds exclusively on marine algae, and they are able to retain the chloroplasts, the photosynthetic organelles of the algae they feed on. And some of them not only do that, but they are through a process that we call horizontal gene transfer. They can take part of the DNA of the algae and use that to help manufacture their own photosynthetic products. And so they're really very clever organisms in terms of the adaptations they have for survival. So if food disappears from their environment, they can actually produce their own food through the genes that they acquire and the chloroplasts that they get from the plants they feed on.
So they're actually farming algae in their own tissue.
They are.
Wow.
Yes, exactly.
And that's the food they're making. It almost sounds like coral. You know what coral do with algae?
Well, it's exactly the same kind of thing. And we find a lot of marine organisms, and particularly ones in the organisms in the tropics, have this symbiosis between algal cells and harbor them in their tissues. And some of them get up to 50% of their nutrition from the photosynthetic products of their algae.
Do they pass this on? I mean, when their offspring, once they get take over this DNA?
There's some evidence based on the fact that there are chloroplasts in the eggs of the nudibranchs that they are able to pass them on. But we also know that they can acquire them when they're adults and juveniles.
Now, there is a sea slug called Glaucus atlanticus that has an interesting defense. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it floats around in the open ocean, in tropical oceans, and it's able to float because it swallows a big air bubble, and it feeds on the Portuguese man-o-war. And what it does is it's able to take the stinging cells of the Portuguese man-o-war and use it for its own defense and fire them at will. And so these things often wash up on tropical shores, and people inadvertently see this bright silver and blue thing on the beach and pick it up, and they get the same sting that they would if they'd picked up a Portuguese man-o-war.
And that is painful, I can tell you from personal experience. I'm Ira Flatow.
It's no fun.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. You know, we just think that, you know, this is a fascinating world of sea slugs. Are any of these sea slugs the kind that Eric Kandel used to study in his famous nervous system studies that he won the Nobel Prize for?
They are exactly some of the same things. Those are sea hares that have giant nerve cells, and that's why they're so appropriate for neurophysiological studies, is you can stimulate individual cells because they're so large. And it's allowed us to look at primitive nervous systems as a model for understanding the evolution of more complex systems like our own.
I think it gave us a new appreciation. I'm sure you've gotten that appreciation a while back as you studied sea slugs.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Any? Do you have a favorite one?
I have a favorite one, and it changes almost daily as soon as I see another new one that we discover. And that's what makes it so exciting, is that there's always new discoveries and new insights into these amazing organisms that are great indicators of climate change and environmental sensitivity.
Wait, so the sea slugs are sort of the canaries of the oceans there?
Well, that's what we feel, and because they are, you know, like the Hopkins rose, suddenly becoming abundant is an indicator of the warmer water. We also see the cycles that they go through, the way they extend and retract their ranges in response to warming and cooling conditions in the ocean. So they're really good indicators of changing environments.
I see you have a very boring job in front of you.
Oh, it's terrible. I hate it.
Somebody's got to do it. Well, I'm glad you took some time to share your love of sea slugs with us. We don't get that often, you know.
It's my pleasure.
Terry Gosliner is a senior curator of invertebrate zoology and geology at the California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco. May all your sea slugs be beautiful.
Thank you very much.
The chemist Carl Girasi, often known as the father of the pill, passed away last Friday at the age of 91. He came to this country at the age of 16, an Austrian Jewish refugee from Nazi Europe. He went on to do crucial work leading to the development of the birth control pill, for which he received the National Medal of Science. As if that wasn't enough, he became a full-time writer at the age of 75, penning dozens of books and plays. Girasi was the first, was the true definition of a Renaissance man, and we spoke to him back in 2004, where he explained his views on communicating science. Dr. Girasi, you call your work science in fiction, your playwriting. In this case, science in theater, as a way to bring science to the general audience, make it more accessible. Would that be fair to describe it that way?
No.
I knew I was going to be wrong on that one.
I want to use a smuggling device.
A smuggling device.
Because if I admit that I really want to make it more accessible, a lot of people are already turned off, because they don't want to even learn. So instead of telling them I want to explain to you in easy language something about science or scientists, I simply want to say I want to tell you a story.
It's Carl Girasi, author, playwright, and father of the pill, who passed away last week at the age of 91. We at Science Friday remember his passionate science communication abilities, his always willing to appear on our program. He certainly was a friend of the show, and we send condolences to his friends and family. That's about all the time we have. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And if you missed any part of the program, hey, maybe you'd like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts, or subscribe to our audio and video stuff. Point your tablet or smartphone to our website, sciencefriday.com, where we invite you to join our mailing list, and you'll get notices of all the good stuff that's coming up on Science Friday. And if you like us, like us on Facebook. And, of course, we're going all week long with Facebook, and also we tweet all week long at Science Friday. Our handle is SciFry. You want to write us, send your letters to the old-fashioned way, the classical way, Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, New York, New York, 10036, and you can email us, scifry@sciencefriday.com. Have a great weekend. In New York, I'm Ira Flatow.